Welcome, McPherson. Just reported that you are stuck on the traffic. The agenda before us talks of the presentations. The item of draft minutes, I was just proposing that we have it after, just before the closing remarks of the meeting, so that we can be able to pick up the presentations first and deal with our minutes later. So because they were still printing the copies of the minutes, so that they can circulate to members now, and then we actually can be able to have a look at them before we close our meeting. I'm moving that consideration of draft minutes to an item just before closing remarks. With that amendment, I would like to put the agenda before the committee for acceptance, I would say.
Thank you, Chairperson. I move for adoption of the agenda with the amendments.
Thank you. Can we get the seconder, Tau?
Good morning, everyone. I second the adoption of the agenda.
I'm sure if ever there's any objection, I will actually see the hand. If not, can we then proceed to actually look at the next item? We do actually have before us the commissioner and the team. Umamunduli, welcome. We would actually then ask the commissioner to then just introduce herself and the team, and obviously we will then proceed to taking the presentations which you have for us. Thank you very much. Welcome to you and the team, Mamduli. Floor is yours.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, everyone, honorable members. And just to thank the committee for giving us an opportunity to come and engage with the parliament that has basically created the legislation in terms of which we are established as the commission. Chair, I will just allow the members of the commission to introduce themselves, as well as the members of the Department of Trade and Industry who are also present here. My name is Zodwan Duli, I'm the commissioner for the BBB commission, and then I'll allow the colleagues to introduce themselves.
Good morning, Chair and honourable members. It's Busisiwe Ngwenya. I'm the Executive Manager Compliance Division within the Commission. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Nontoko Zonokwalimboyi. I'm the Chief Operations Officer at the BEE Commission.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Mwipone Kawisile, Executive Manager, Investigation and Enforcement.
Good morning, members. My name is Teboho Sotetsi from DTI, Director for Policy, Law and Legislation.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Nondombi Madomela. I'm the Acting Group Chief Operations Officer for the DTI.
We do actually have regulars the COO acting. So we would actually then ask that we proceed with the presentation. Maybe request the commissioner to take us through. And then obviously I think we will then take comments, questions for clarity at the end of your presentation. The floor is yours. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Chair. We are going to just split the presentation between the two of us, myself and Busisiwe, just in the interest of proper engagements. But when it comes to any questions, then the entire team will be able to come in terms of the various areas of their responsibilities to do so. Chair, maybe I think the first thing that we need to do is to introduce the commission, particularly taking advantage of the fact that this is our first engagement with this committee in this administration, and we really welcome this opportunity, and we look forward to constructive engagements in the committee, but as well as directly with the commission itself on any matters that the this committee would like to know about our activities, about what we're doing, and any information that the members may require. Chair, we have already introduced the team, and as you would have seen, the team is 100% black women. It is in line with the demographics of this country, and we want to maintain and keep the empowerment of women. But yes, we are not anti-males. We'll still continue as we fill all the other positions in the executive structure to be more diverse. But the majority will continue to be black women, and that's what we will ensure on an ongoing basis. Chair, the presentation content is outlined there, and I will just introduce the presentation. Ms. Ngwenya will take us immediately in from the presentation, from processes up until the whole part relating to our operational implementation, and I will then take over from slide 19 to the end of the presentation. Chair, as the Commission, when we were established in 2016, we did go through our strategic session, and if you look at our vision, our mission and our values, you'll see that our mission and our vision particularly are derived from the legislation that we are supposed to be implementing. But there are specifically important keywords in the mission and the vision. So if you look at our mission, you'll see that we are saying that we are going to facilitate the accelerated productive implementation of the BBB legislation. Accelerated particularly because since 2003, when the BBB legislation was passed to facilitate economic empowerment of black people in this country who were previously marginalized, not much progress was done. So the country in a way lost a lot of opportunity to advance economic transformation. So the role of this commission is therefore to ensure that we facilitate the acceleration of that, that we do not spend another decade, and when we look back, then we realize that we have not even achieved 50% of what was expected. So we would like to emphasize the acceleration thereof. And in terms of our vision, it continues to be an inclusive economy. An inclusive economy is an economy that is not intended to exclude anybody in the future. But what it does is that it recognizes that there were a majority of the people in this country that were excluded. So we need to include them in the economy. Our economy needs to be inclusive. We need to achieve equality. We need to make sure that black people meaningfully participate in this economy. So we'll continue to pursue that. So that is what we'd like to achieve in line with what is expected. And Chair, just as a reflection, the BBB legislation, as I indicated, was passed in 2003. When it was passed in 2003, it was after the employment equity legislation was passed in 1998 to transform the workplace, to transform all the levels of employment in the workplace. And the economic empowerment of black people was then addressed through the BBB legislation, which was passed in 2003. And in 2007, the Department of Trade and Industry for the first time issued what we call the Codes of Good Practice that are saying, how do you then bring about this kind of economic empowerment that we are talking about? And in doing so, it identified specific elements that we should be measuring as a country on an ongoing basis. And these elements are derived from exactly the preamble in our Constitution, Section 9 as well of the Constitution, which talks about the right to equality, and it also aligns to the constitution in terms of section 217. And if you look at that, the intention is to ensure that the people that were previously marginalized are now included in the economy for a meaningful participation. And we underline meaningful. And you'll see as we then engage with the committee throughout the day that the meaningful participation that we're talking about is undermined on a daily basis by certain practices that are so unscrupulous from the various entities, from the various verification agencies, from the various people that are willingly fronting themselves to undermine the achievement of economic empowerment in this country. So we'll show you as we present, Chair, some of the challenges that this country needs to deal with and to deal with decisively, because we cannot continue to say we want economic empowerment in our lifetime, but we continue to undermine it ourselves. So, pursuant to the legislation, the codes as they were passed, there are key elements that are measured, and those are in the general codes. The first one being ownership. So we measure ownership in terms of whether there is a transfer of ownership of the productive assets of this economy into the hands of black people who were previously excluded from owning assets in this economy. Excluded by design through the apartheid legislation that was in place in this country. And some continue to be excluded because of denied access, for instance, to funding. That continues on a daily basis, where entrepreneurs with skills, with potentials, still continue to be denied access to finance. And as a result, they cannot create sustainable businesses. They cannot create sustainable markets. They cannot even penetrate some of the markets. And we continue to lament every day that we say that there's a failure rate of black businesses or black entrepreneurs, black enterprises. And why are the reasons for such failures? When they create those enterprises, they need the markets. But if you've got the market structure that is already dominated by monopolies, dominated by historical value chains that do not allow any new entry by any black entrepreneurs, you are setting them up for failure. We're setting the black businesses for failure. So it is important that while we support the creation of new black entrepreneurs, new black enterprises, that we also deal with the market structures. The market structures cannot continue to remain the way they are, because then we are again undermining the very same purpose that the BBB legislation seeks to achieve. The second element is the issue of management control. That in this country, it continues day in, day out, year in, year out. When we do statistics, the decision-making power still lies with the historically advantaged people. Black people continue to occupy only about 38% of the executive positions in terms of board levels, in terms of executive positions in entities. The over 62% of their positions, decision-making in various industries of the economy, even critical industries, still remain in the hands of white people. And so it is important that in as much as we facilitate ownership, but we need to also facilitate the representativity of black people in making decisions in the strategic areas of this economy. So it is important that the boards of the various entities that operate in this country reflect the demographics of this country. And you will see that in the codes of good practice, when it speaks about ownership, management control, it does indicate how much should be there in terms of black management, and it will indicate 50% black control. It will also go further to say at least in that 50% black, it should be 25% women. So there are targets that are already set that everybody should be guided by. So there's no excuse for any entity in this country to say we're not clear about what are the targets. And every entity has got the flexibility to pace itself in their own strategy to say how do we want to achieve this. That is the one thing that is important and that I want to emphasize about the BBB legislation, that it provides the necessary flexibilities not to be a burden to business, but to be a process that facilitates inclusion, the process that facilitates transformation in our entities. The third element is skills development. Black people were completely excluded from the critical skills that are required in this economy. So the third element that we measure is skills development. So in terms of this element, all entities in this country, including government entities, public entities, are required to contribute 6% of the payroll yearly towards training and skilling black people in their organizations and those that are not in their organization. This is done through various means, through learnerships, through internships, through on-the-job training that is recognized, with a view of ensuring that we also get the absorption of these people in the entity or in other entities where their skills would be required. And yes, we have challenges, as would indicate during the presentation, in terms of some of the trained learners who hop from one learnership to another, because there isn't a coordinated effort in this country to make sure that the skills that they are given are skills that will actually put them in a situation where they're immediately absorbed after finishing. So we need to integrate that. We need to have a coordination between business and government and the other social partners to ensure that we are able to make the impact. The fourth element, which is critical, is the enterprise and supplier development. In the enterprise and supplier development, basically what this element says is that all entities, government and private sector entities, must contribute 2% towards developing the supply chain, meaning that they must have new suppliers that are black on their supply database. Whoever they're dealing with, now they've got targets that are set to say, if your database had so many entities and you had no 51% black-owned entities, you had no black entrepreneurs, you need to make a process to facilitate their entry into your supply chain. So you need to spend 2% of your net profit after tax towards that. And under that, the subcategory is the enterprise development, meaning that we hear all the time companies saying that, you know, but we cannot find those black entities in this industry. If you are not creating them, you're not going to find them. So now what this says is that the entities need to create these entrepreneurs. So that is why you've got enterprise development programs in some entities where they identify black entrepreneurs that are already playing in that space but are not necessarily viable, and you provide them financial and non-financial support. That could include interest-free loans, it includes office space, free office space for their operations so that they can grow and be a viable supplier to you as an entity or to any other entity in the market that they're operating. So there, we're looking at about 3% basically in total of the net profit after tax. So it's the 2% and the 1%. And then in conclusion, there's the socio-economic development. This is anything, any measure that an entity can put in place to facilitate the participation of black people in the economy. So it includes any initiative that a company can put in place or a government entity can put in place to achieve that. Chair, I think it was important for us to just highlight that, because we continue on a daily basis when we speak about women empowerment in this country. At some point, it's as if there is nothing. The codes are very clear in terms of black women interventions. It's very clear. The targets are very clear. And so it is important that we know exactly what the piece of legislation that this parliament has passed is seeking to achieve, and make sure that we're implementing it, particularly to achieve exactly that. Chair, we are then established as the Commission in terms of Section 13B of the BBB legislation. This is because of the realization in 2011 when a review of the 2003 legislation was done. It was very clear that a lot of things have not been achieved at all, particularly because no one was monitoring what was happening. Firstly, there was no guidance in terms of what is it that companies must do. So everyone did as they please. And as part of that process, we also had mushrooming agencies and consultants that were advising entities differently. And most of them were actually advising them to circumvent the Act as opposed to applying the Act properly. So now the role of the regulator, which is the BBB Commission, is to oversee the implementation of the legislation to ensure that it achieves its objectives. So in Section 13F of our Act, our functions are articulated strictly there. But I think I'm going to just highlight three of these functions. The first one being the power for the Commission to oversee at any time on a daily basis the implementation. How we do that, we've got media monitoring on a daily basis. We monitor transactions that are reported. We also monitor conduct and practices. We also monitor patterns and trends. And the second other function that is important is our function to receive complaints and investigate complaints. And that is a critical function as well, particularly because we can proactively investigate companies, but we can also respond to a complaint from any person, including just a tip-off. And the third important aspect is around the registration of what we call major BEE transactions. These are ownership deals that are concluded in this country where the value of the transaction is at 25 million and above. So once the deal achieves that value, it must be registered with the Commission. When it's filed with us, our job is to register it, and then after registering it within 10 days, it will be publicly available on our website for you and everybody else to know what BEE deal has been registered. However, on our side, once we have registered it and it's available publicly, our job is to assess it and see if it meets the requirements of the legislation. And then where we have non-alignment, we then provide an individual feedback to the company, and we then also allow them an opportunity to fix it if there are things that we do not believe are aligned. And the fourth function that is also important is the requirement for all entities in this country that are JSE listed, all organs of state, all public entities, all CETAs, as in S-E-T-A, all of them on an annual basis are required to submit their reports to the Commission to say how they are doing in implementing BBBE themselves. That information the Commission will then look at, will assess, and will still provide individual feedback to the companies and also encourage some of them to comply if we feel that they continue to give us a non-compliance status. And we also offer free training to all of these entities so that we can assist them to move to the right direction. So, Chair, that's our mandate. I'll hand over to Ms. Ngwenya. But I thought that it is important because of the fact that we're engaging with this committee for the first time to just see where we're coming from, what our mandate is, and so that you can then look at our performance for this particular period under review within the context of what we are required to do. Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner. Chair, I'll skip the priorities because we'll be looking at it when we're doing the annual report. So I'll link it with the annual report. Okay, thank you. So our processes is that we are required to receive complaints, or we can initiate on our own, and the legislation gives us 12 months, up to 12 months to investigate a matter. but there are matters depending on the complexity or in terms of funders not getting all the documents that you require that may go over the period. But in terms of the legislation, you're required to take over up to 12 months to investigate a matter. We also do offer what you call advisory opinions. Now, these are on initiatives or structures that people might want to put into place. So before they do that, they will come to us and say to us, can you give us guidance to see whether what you want to put into place would not contravene the legislation. We give ourselves 30 days on this matter, and I must say that so far, Chairperson, we've managed to give the opinion in less than 30 days. Only in certain matters, which are complex, but very few of them will go over 30 days. And then the BBB registration, as the Commission has mentioned, that we also are required to register transactions. We have to issue a registration of within 10 days, but it depends on whether we get all the documentations that are required within time. Where we don't, at times we end up rejecting those transactions. But also what we do then is that after issuing the registration certificate, we then assess the transaction just to check whether it's aligned with the objectives of the legislation. With the compliance reports, we also are given 90 days through the regulations to assess them and then provide feedback to the companies. And I must say on that score, we have actually managed to issue assessments most of the time within 60 days. And what we've also started doing now, as well as site visits, where we'll write formally to companies to say whether they say they're doing, they have a level one, to say, can you come and benchmark and see whether what you're presenting is the right reflection or not. And we find that most of them are doing well, but there might be areas of concern that we would raise them with them to correct. Or when a company is not doing too well or they're non-compliant, that means they are less than they got less than level 8. That's called non-compliant. Level 8 is like the lowest you can get. So if you get less than, if you don't get the level 8, that means you really are not implementing BBBEE. So we also meet with those just to assist them to see whether there are gaps that they might need training or assistance with. And then we also offer what you call written clarifications, that is the interpretation of the law, where we then assist people to say we issue this within 5 days, but most of the time our turnaround time is 3 days, at times it's 1 day, depending on the complexity of the matter, where we give guidance on the interpretation of the legislation. These are free services for now, so we do advise people to take care of that. Now, the operational implementation, what we have done is that we have grouped them into the different divisions that we've got. So we have 5 divisions, which is your compliance division, investigations, stakeholder relations, operations, and research and analysis. So we'll go over each one. When you looked at our priorities that were projected earlier, one of the first ones that we came out with when we were doing our strategic session was to say we want to safeguard the outcomes of the inclusive economy. Now, how we do that? We do that by giving guidance on the implementation of the Act, and one of the things that we do then is to offer advisory opinions. During this period, which is 18-19 and quota 2, we issued 50 advisory opinions. We issued 1,810 clarifications, and then we also issued 56 letters. These are in regard to your invalid BBBEE certificates, because what you find is that there are still accountants who will issue BBBEE certificates to your exempt micro enterprises and your qualifying small enterprises that only require a SONA fit of it. So normally we don't then send that for investigation because we feel we can just notify the particular company to say you surely should be using a SONA fit of it, not a BBBEE certificate. But also we do find BBBEE certificates that are invalid. When you find those as well, then we'll write to the entities to tell them. At times you find a company operating with 2 BBBEE certificates. That is not allowed. So depending on the matter, we might refer the matter for investigation, or we might just require them to withdraw the certificate and get re-verified. So those are some of the things. And then you can find a list of the invalid certificates on our website if you want to see which companies have been written to. What you also do is that we issue what you call practice guides or practice notes. So it turns out that there will be a recurring matter that keeps coming up and up and up. And then what you'll do then is that you'll do a practice guide just to guide the market to say, when you're dealing with this particular issue, this is how you need to look at it. Some of the British guides that we have issued were on third-party procurement. We have just issued one on multinationals, because there have been a lot of interpretation on the market where some multinationals will tell us that they are required to give a 51% black shareholding. There's no way in the legislation where it says a company must give 51% black shareholding. The minimum in the generics is 25.1%. So we then, when we come across such, we need to then guide the market and tell them how to interpret the legislation. We also do or produce what you call educational guides. These are pamphlets. I think we issued some of them, where we have issued now one on startups, we issued one on trust, we issued one also on the YES program, because we got a lot of questions when the YES program came out, so we thought maybe we need to do a guide on the YES program as well. We have also issued one on socio-economic development, because what you find is that people confuse corporate social investment with SED, and these are two different initiatives. I normally say to people, when you look at SED, you must think of it as not giving a person a fish, but actually teaching them how to fish, so that even you stop supporting them, they're able to sustain themselves moving forward. And then also in terms of compliance, what we do, as we mentioned, is that we look at, we receive major transactions. For 18-19 and the second quarter, we received 152 BBB transactions. And then 26 of those were rejected because there was outstanding information. We do give companies time to submit all the required documents, but if within a certain period you would not have received anything, then we have to reject because it's outstanding on our records. And then we also issued then 108 BBB registration certificates. That means that those transactions were registered. And then after that, only then can we then assess the transactions. We also received 279 compliance reports, and 247 of those were assessed. Now, when we move into the investigations, which is the second element division that we have, you see that at most of the complaints that are lodged, majority are on fronting. So 84% were on fronting of the 285 that we received between 18 and 19 and quarter two. And then what you call merit assessment report is that once a matter has been received, they look at it and then they'll do a report, what you call a merit assessment report. And then 50 of those cases, 90 of those cases were finalized. And then we also issued 27 summons. So when you issue summons, is that you write to a respondent and ask for information to say, we're requesting this and this and that. Some people will ignore you, or they will just refuse to give the information. So the legislation does give us powers to issue summons. And we can also do the on-site visits as well as part of doing that, going with the sheriff of the law. And then three cases were published during 18-19 and quarter two. These were on ESCOM, BE Matrix, and MTN. What we're looking at there, for instance, ESCOM, is that they issued a tender and they required a level four. But then when they finally issued the contract, they gave it to a company that was zero black owned, whereas their own requirements were for a level four company. So they actually flouted their own internal tender processes. With BE Matrix, is that they were not compliant to the verification process, where they were issuing invalid certificates. And with the MTN scheme, it was more on the trust to say their trust was not aligned with the trust rules and also the ownership requirements. And then what we also issued is we resolved 10 cases through what you call alternative dispute resolution, because there are some cases where you find that there is a contravention. But then instead of referring a matter for prosecution, you find that maybe it would be better, especially for the black person who has already lost out a lot, to say, can you settle it through alternative dispute resolution? So some have actually managed to get something back where they would not have benefited maybe for a period of 5 or 10 years, and then through the ADR they might get something back. And then also what we require from companies is that they also give something towards NASFAS to support the school kids. And then we also referred 14 cases to Companies and IP Commission. These are cases mostly where there's corporate governance or corporate governance violation. So we require them to look at those cases, or director, delinquent directors as well, where we feel that somebody must be declared as a delinquent director so that they cannot operate again or open another company. And then we also referred cases to a national prosecuting authority and to staffs as well. So when we issue out some of these ADR, we issue them with compliance notice, and then we have to monitor that they actually comply with the requirements. And then under Program 3, which deals with research, report, and analysis, we then look at the status of transformation to see, are we transforming as a country? Where do we stand? That's where the commissioner was reporting on the case of when you look at management control, for instance, where it's still 38%. Black people in management position. And normally what worries us is that you find a company saying that they are 51% black owned. But then you look at their triple B certificate, they will get 7 points for management control. Already that tells us that there's a problem, because you can't say you are majority black owned and score so low on management control. So those are the things that we also look at. So we have issued three reports on national status. This is based on the compliance reports that we receive, but also we have a portal, we call it the BBB certificate portal system, where verifiers will then put or upload the BBB certificate, and from there we'll then get information that we analyze and then give the report. We have the national status report that you have issued on our website, but you can also send it through if members are interested to read more on it. We also did the analysis of BBB measure report transaction. There is a report on that as well. The commissioner will expand on that. And then under relationship, stakeholder relations, which is a program 4, what the legislation requires us to do as well is to have collaborations with certain entities. Some of them are listed in the Act itself. So we have signed 9 memorandum of understandings with institutions like your CIPC, your SARS, and particularly with SARS, because we've seen that there may be cases, especially when doing measure BBB transaction analysis. You'll find a matter that for BBB, maybe there might not be issues, but you think that there might be tax deviations. So we need to report those to SARS, for instance. So agreements have that we have put in place. We also now signed one with your National Liquor Authority and your Ports Regulator of SA. And last week we had a roundtable discussion with all our partners to see how we take the partnership forward. And then the last program is our administration, which deals with issues of ICT operations. And what we did is that we put into place in a 5-year ICT strategy, which has developed and is being implemented. And some of the systems that we've put into place is the portal I spoke of. And what is also wonderful is that CSD is going to be linked with this portal, so that when you're looking at BBB certificates, when you're looking at a company through CSD, you can also link into this portal to see what the company looks like in terms of their BBB certificate. And then also we're putting into place a human resource system, your case management system and contact center system, because these are systems that you think we require. And then we've also trained 10 officials on the MTP BBB program. We'll be also rolling out the next phase. And we have 2 graduates currently on the program. As you see, it says nil. We have not budgeted for graduates because we don't have proper operating space currently. So we have put that on hold, but it's something that we'll implement as soon as we have our own space. Chairperson, the last time we were here, we were clobbered a bit to say when it comes to awareness sessions, we seem to be focusing more in urban areas than rural areas. Yes, and we took that into heart. So what we have started doing this year is that we're rolling out what you call provincial conferences. So wherever we go, we then arrange to transport people from outlying areas to whichever venue that we would have gotten. So far we've been to Mpumalanga, we've been to Eastern Cape, Northern Cape, Western Cape. Next week we'll be going to Free State, and then in December we're doing Northwest, and then in January we're doing Gauteng. We thought this time we need to put Gauteng last. And then we'll have our annual conference then in March in KZN. So this has been quite useful, Chair, because then it means, because what you have done is that you have partnered with other state organs, like your funding institutions, your support institutions, so that when people come into these sessions, then they get the full bouquet of government services, and they are able to register immediately. Like with Treasury, they bring somebody to register them on the CSD on the spot. So that has been quite a useful exercise. And we also launched our Women Empowerment Conference last year. So this year we're in Limpopo with the conference. And what we normally target is 500 people. But in the Eastern Cape, we actually had over 700 people attending. So, you know, it's quite heartening when you get such support. Now, these are just stats that we already presented, just to show you then in figures what you look at. So in 1819, we issued 37 advisory opinions. But when you look at quota 2 for this year, you can see we already issued 13 advisory opinions just in one quarter. So the demand for the service has gone up. And then complaints, we received 187 for 1819. And for quarter 2 alone this year, we are already at 98. So the awareness sessions that we're doing, I think, has raised awareness. People now know what is fronting. And then in terms of complaints received and initiated, 1819, we initiated 166, on fronting, 169, on BBB certificate, 27. Contractually, TB issues that are not BBB related, but contractual issues, maybe partners not seeing eye to eye anymore, we received 11 of those, and then we didn't have any misleading adverts. For quarter 2, on fronting, we received 68 complaints. Some of these are initiated by the Commission itself based on tip-offs, or at times people who write to us and say, we think there's something wrong with this company, and we're seeing a lot of competitors now reporting each other, which helps. But then you just have to be careful that people are not using you to report a computer when there's nothing happening. And then BBB certificate, 19. And then contractual issues, we received only 2. So probably because people have become aware of what issues we look at as the commission and what you not look at. Now, what we've also done is to show you per sector where most of the complaints are prevalent. Mining is still leading, and I think even the last time we came here, we mentioned that. And then you also have engineering and transport still being the sectors that have the most highest reported cases on fronting. Yeah. And then walk-ins and telephone calls and meetings, this is just to show you who we deal with and the number. So for walk-ins, it's people who just walk in without an appointment, and most of them want to come and complain or lay a formal complaint. Some of them would be scared to use a phone because the only phone they might have is of the person that they want to report. So they prefer to come and engage with us personally. So we had 126 people coming in for walk-ins for 1819, 35 for quarter 2. Telephone calls, 1819, 2,307. Meetings that were held last year, 179. For quarter 2, it was 56, and then we had 260 telephone inquiries. And then notice of investigations issued, we had 19 for 1819 on fronting, and the notice of non-investigation is where the matter really doesn't raise any BBB consent, just 42. And then regulation of when we issue letters on matters, maybe there's the matter we need more information, we issued 88 of those, and then we issued 20 summons. And then for quarter 2, notice of investigation, we issued 6, non-investigation, 22, and then we issued 61 letters, and we issued 7 summons. Now, investigations where findings were issued, and there's ADR and referrals. For 1819, it was 134 matters that were decided on, and then investigations reports that were finalized, it was 67, and findings that were issued were 48. And then we also had 9 alternative dispute resolutions matters, and we had 12 referrals to other institutions. And then for quarter 2, we issued merit reports at 61, investigation reports 86, and then you issued 42 findings, and then one ADR, and then five findings, that's final findings. I'll stop there, Chairperson, and give over to the Commissioner.
Chair, having highlighted our operational implementation element, obviously we continue to also do an analysis, an overall analysis of the work that we do, as we've indicated, in respect of Measure B transactions as well as the compliance reports. But Chair, before I get into that, I just want to add to say that in most of the cases where we have now issued summons, we have realized that some of the entities or some of the individuals, when we request information through a letter, the response that we get from their lawyers is that, but the Commission has not issued us with a summons. So they don't want to voluntarily give information. So you'll see that now, in fact, starting from last year, there's an increase in our summons, because what we find is that there's a delay tactic to really prolong the submission of information to the Commission to their very last day when the Commission has finally issued the summons. But generally, we do get cooperation. In most of the cases that we're dealing with, when we request the information that we need, the companies do give us information. And Chair, the other thing that I must just also mention is that in terms of the central supplier database, which is a database that government uses to procure services or to look for service providers, we are increasingly picking up that companies have actually, they have multiple registration on that central supplier database. One company could have four registrations, but if you go to their ownership information, their BBB compliance information is different in each one of those registrations. For particular reasons, some may be misrepresenting their status. You'll find that in one registration, they are 51% black-owned. In another one, they are purely 100% white-owned. In another one, so depending on what deal they are submitting or what procurement opportunity they are submitting, they will use this particular registration number on the central supplier database. So our constant engagement with Treasury should be able to highlight and align these things. But as Busi indicated, our phase two of the BBB portal is now going to be linked, in a sense that the information that is on the central supplier database will be verified real time with the BBB portal, so that, you know, when you then get into the central supplier database, it's not about just what the company says, but it will be verified by the Commission through that portal. So we're hoping that we can then stop some of those gymnastics that are happening in the database. Chair, when the Measure B transactions were submitted, the first part, the Minister issued the notice in 2017 in June. Then in that first year, we received 275 transactions. So on analysis of the transactions, we picked up that about three of them were actually a duplication. So the parties, because it's multiple parties, they submitted individually. So it then gave us a 275 figure for that period. So what we then did is to just look at these transactions to say, what is the nature of these transactions? Who is funding these transactions? What's happening in them? What is expected to be achieved? Because these are ownership transactions. Ultimately, at the end of the day, the value that you see in these transactions must be the value that vests in black hands, ultimately. So if it's ownership transaction, ownership must ultimately vest in black hands. So what we then do is then we started now doing an annual analysis of those transactions that are filed. So we started with the one, the first batch, which is from 2017 to 2018. So the next report will obviously look from 2018 to 2019. And that report is in the process now of being analyzed by our independent service provider. So in the 272 analysis that we've done, you'll see there in our slide 17 that in terms of the expected black ownership that is going to be transferred according to just these 272 transactions, you'll see that, for instance, in Agri, you expected that there's going to be black ownership of about 76%. That is based on the documents that were submitted to us. So the job of the commission now is to monitor those transactions to ensure that this value is actually the value that is going to be realized in black hands for real. And Chair, the reason why I'm emphasizing that is that in this country we've had very big BEE deals that were announced, celebrated, ribbon cut, but those deals do not translate into real ownership in black hands. Most of those deals fold before the rights vest in the black person. And in that way, we continue to be in the same place, or we regress in terms of ownership, because a deal is structured for 10 years, and come year 6, then the deal is refinanced, continuing to over-indebt the black person. And at the end, then the black person does not realize the value of that particular asset. It doesn't vest in their hands. Then at the end of the term, a black person is still owing in terms of that asset. And what happens is that the asset will be sold back to the very same company at a nominal price, or at a price already set in at the time, at the beginning, when the transaction was actually structured. So we have what we call, basically it's sort of warehousing. Black people are warehousing the shares. But for that 10 years, the company will get a tick that it is black owned, but actually there's no black ownership that is going to vest at the end. So in terms of the analysis of those transactions, as I say, that slide 17 is indicating what is expected according to the agreements. This is the black ownership that should be able to transfer to black people in this country when we look at it in terms of impact. Then if you look at the next slide, which is slide 18, when we assess the total value, as I've indicated, the value of the transaction, the threshold is 25 million. So the total value of these 272 transactions is 188 billion. So what you will expect is that that value should be the value that really translates into real black ownership and real value that will grow year in, year out in the hands of black people. So that's basically what we have there. But then when we then analyzed who is funding these deals, so in these ownership deals, who is funding them? You will see that most of these deals are vendor financed, meaning that they are financed by the companies where that black person is acquiring a stake. So meaning that the company borrows you money to buy a stake in them. So the only downside of a vendor financing arrangement is where there are conditions that are so strict that your ownership rights are restricted. When your ownership rights are restricted, we then call that a fronting arrangement. Because in terms of the legislation, if you are an owner, your voting rights must not be interfered with. So where we find a vendor finance arrangement, ordinarily companies will put a provision where the black owner cedes the voting rights to the very same entity that has provided the funding. So basically what it means is that the very same entity is exercising the ownership rights that are supposed to be exercised by the black person. So when you look at that, that is just a fronting arrangement. So we're saying that as much as there is good in the vendor financing arrangement, because it makes available funding for people that would ordinarily not get finance, maybe from an ordinary bank or from a government institution, but we are concerned as the commission about the conditions in the vendor financing. So we do scrutinize that, and where there are limitations, we do then write back to the entities to change those. So those restrictions are not allowed. And what we then also picked up is that the second method of funding is the banking institutions, the financial institutions. So that is the second category of funding. So you'll see that the majority of these deals are funded by vendor financing and by the financial institutions in the private sector. And if you look at government funding, Chair, you'll see that government institutions only funded less than 2% of these deals. meaning that there isn't enough funding from the government side of things to finance equity acquisitions by black people. And it's something that we will appeal that it should be improved, in a sense that every funding institution must have a certain percentage that is allocated to finance BEE deals, and so that black people are able then to economically enter the market. And it's something that we're really particularly passionate about in that way. Chair, the compliance reports, as Ms. Ngwenya has indicated, we do an analysis on an annual basis to look at where we are as the country, how we're doing. But this is based on only the reports that we receive. In terms of the reports that we've received, we have not received sufficient number of reporting, both from the JSE listed companies as well as from government or the public sector itself. I indicated it is a must for all of these entities to submit these reports. We have struggled in the beginning because the requirement was new, so we have done awareness, but we are seeing an improvement, but it's still very slow. With the CETAs, you'll notice that the CETAs, you know, it's very low again. So in government in general is low. The JSE listed companies, we are not at even 50% of the JSE listed companies reporting. But based on the assessment of the information that has been received, Chair, I've moved directly to slide number 23 because it's the summary of this analysis. In that slide, you'll see that in terms of the element of ownership, when we measure how we're doing, the country is regressing. When we did the benchmark in 2016, the country was at 32% black ownership. And in this case, remember that we did not distinguish between direct, indirect, the ones in through trust and all of those. We did not distinguish. But in total, it was around 32%. Today, we're sitting at around 25%. So we're regressing. Part of the reasons could be because most of the deals that were purported to be black ownership deals are folding. So ownership reverts to the original owners. And some of the interfering aspects were the measurements, because other entities indicated that they had to undo some of their ownership deals because of the new changes in the codes and so forth and so forth. So there may be a number of reasons for that. But what we are happy about, Chair, I suppose it's yeah, happiness, but a bit relative. We have seen an improvement in skills development contributions. A number of entities on average are at least exceeding 50% of their targets. In 2017, they were not even meeting 50% of the target. The same goes for the enterprise and supply development. So we've seen at least over 60% of the targets are being met. So it is an indication that in this country there is willingness to achieve the codes, as long as the entities are being assisted and that entities do not take a tick box approach towards all of this. Chair, in conclusion, we have covered our activities for the last year and quarter one, but Chair, would like to indicate that it is important for us to look at the provisions of the Act. We look at the objectives of the Act to see what was intended, and at all times we measure ourselves against that. But I think what is also important to highlight is that Section 10 of the legislation is very clear. When Busi was indicating that we made findings against ESCOM, it was particularly because they just blatantly disregarded Section 10. And Section 10 does not make an option for any entity not to follow it. It says it must. All organs of state must apply the codes. All of them, they must. In their procurement, you cannot issue a tender and say that you require level 4. Then at the end, you disregard that, and then you go for something that is completed. That's manipulation, and that opens up this country for corruption, unnecessarily so. And it's something that we must emphasize. Chair, but also just to say that the consequences in the legislation for non-compliance are very clear. But we will say to you that there are limitations for us to effectively achieve that. In terms of the consequences, when a company is found to have been fronting or to have misrepresented its triple B status, that company is guilty of a criminal offense, basically. However, It is a requirement that we take it through a criminal process for a normal, ordinary court to make that conviction before the penalties can be imposed. And that process is what we have raised with this committee before, to say that part of over-criminalizing the legislation and not having administrative penalties that can have consequences immediately for entities through penalties, through fines that can be imposed without necessarily only pursuing a criminal process, which is very cumbersome and where the standard of proof is also extremely high. When on a balance of probabilities, clearly this is fronting, but then for you to impose the sanctions, you need a conviction. So the manner in which the legislation was structured, there's value in, you know, there can be value in just improving that to include the administrative penalties part and the administrative process, in the same way that the competition legislation is like, the company's legislation is like, it allows for both. So you pursue the administrative as well as the criminal process. So in this case, that also ties us up, in a sense that the up to 10% of the turnover, you can only impose it after a conviction in a criminal court. And that cannot be a deterrent enough. In fact, what we are seeing is that the lawyers are advising their clients to say, no, it's okay, don't worry, we'll take the commission on review on this decision, and it will take about 2 years in the review process, and then after that they still have to prosecute you criminally. And if you look at the role at courts, the line is long. So they basically give their clients that, no, it will be maybe 7 years before the commission can really get to you, really, in real terms. So it is important that we look at that. Chair, there's up to 10% of the annual turnover, there's up to 10 years imprisonment for people that are involved in fronting. That includes those that are involved as willing participants, because there are black people that are willing participants that sometimes sit with us in the boardroom when we tell them, you are actually in a fronting arrangement. A person says, no, but I'm too sophisticated to be a front. There's too many of those. Chair, the other consequence for non-compliance is that a company can be excluded from doing business with government for up to 10 years. And then the fourth consequence of non-compliance is that a government entity that is awarded a license, contract, concession, tender to you can cancel it immediately when you are found to have been involved in fronting or misrepresentation of the BBB status. So the penalties are there, the consequences are there, but we do need to improve it so that we are able to pursue both. Chair, we're going to just close it at that, but to say that BBBE presents an opportunity for strategic partnerships between white businesses and black businesses, for transfer of skills that this country requires, but we just need to be properly coordinated. But we are receiving cooperation in the majority of the entities that we're dealing with. There's just a few entities where we're not receiving cooperation. So we are encouraged that this country will achieve what it seeks to achieve in the near future. Thank you very much, Chair.
Maybe one would like just to say that on the presentation slide 26, maybe from 24, we do actually look at the issue of 24 financial plan. There's actually a footnote of the 59 million was allocated to the inaccessible due to BEE commission not being listed. It actually does point out to issues which are important in summary. In the next one, page 25, the same point, current operational with staff, 39 staff members due to lack of office space. So which means I'm just thinking from the slides 24, 25, there is 26 and 27. It's a sort of the conclusion, which may be quite important issues to actually have a discussion from in terms of the conclusion of our presentation. So unless maybe there might be comments from honorable members, we would actually then say, because you have made the presentation, let's actually take comments or and or questions from members. And obviously I do actually think we'll pick it up from there. We'll just have the discussion. Cuthbert, McPherson, Thring, Mulder, Yaku, in that order. Mbuyane.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. It's often recorded that BE and, you know, the mechanisms attached to it are used for rent-seeking and for clientelistic type systems. And in lieu of that, I'd like to ask two questions. The first one being, have you received any complaints regarding political interference in BE transactions? And the second question, have any politicians been subject to investigation for deals that have gone wrong? I think it's important that the public know whether or not politicians are putting their hands into the cookie jar.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Commissioner, for coming. I want to first start off by saying that I'm very grateful for the immense work that the BEE Commission did with respect to a complaint that I laid with yourselves in March of 2017 in connection with fraudulent BEE certificates that had been supplied by Gupta-linked companies to gain contracts from Eskom with the assistance of a verification agency and audit firm. And when I pursue the documents and the level of investigation that was done by yourselves, I think it is nothing short of world class what you did with respect to that investigation. And more so considering that it was done completely internally, which I must be frank, I would have assumed that you would have sought the assistance of outside professionals, but it's very refreshing to see that a government agency, in fact, retains those sorts of professional services in-house. So I want to, on the record and publicly, congratulate you and thank you for the work done. What I can't understand is why it's taken so long for you to publish those findings, despite even publicly saying that you would do so after I sought legal advice around the ability or status of myself to publish those documents, which you know I did do, and the legal advice that I had obtained from senior counsel was that, in fact, the section that you relied on in the Act is most likely unconstitutional and would have not been applicable to me. And I do think it's important that the Commission reviews that section and, in fact, also gets an independent legal opinion on it. You will know that I have laid criminal charges against people named in that report. And I do think it's important that the Commission follows up the progress, along with myself, with the National Prosecuting Authority, to ensure that we make an example of people who seek to steal money from the state under the guise of empowerment or transformation, that they spend time in jail and not just get a fine. With that being said, I want to ask the Commission whether they still believe in the idea that once empowered, always empowered is no longer required. And it's important that we get an honest assessment from the Commission with that. I believe that linking to my last point, but a slide that you spent some time on, in relation as to why BEE transactions have declined or compliance has declined. And I think that is because people who have managed to benefit from these ownership schemes have quite rightly and in a free market economy sought to maximize the value of those transactions that they have been able to participate in and have been able to freely sell them to gain profit and value out of them, and businesses, and I think quite rightly, have said, you know, we've done these transactions, we've become BEE compliant, and now because people through their own free will have sought to sell those shares, those businesses are no longer compliant, and now ineffectively have to re-comply after already discounting the value of their business once. But I think that the once empowered, always empowered rule is a good one, in that it allows people, more people, to benefit instead of the same people benefiting time and again. And also, to what extent do we consider that they are empowered? Is 49 million rands worth of empowerment not enough empowerment? Can you do 10 transactions below the threshold of 50 million rand? And so I'd like you to have a discussion on that. You and I both know, Commissioner, that state compliance with BEE is far worse than in the private sector. And in fact, the state has oftentimes given the middle finger to yourselves and to compliance. And I'd like you to please tell us what is the latest percentage of compliance amongst the state. I understand, and that there's talk amongst the DTI, that there is a move to a more punitive measure or compliance with Triple BEE legislation. Can you please let me know if you have had sight any of that? I must admit, I'm not sure when you had a discussion around the 2% net 2% requirement for supply development, and that was net profit after tax, whether that is in existence now or is in existence to come. If it is in existence right now, okay, I'll leave that then. What is the Commission doing to stop the abuse of BEE by SOEs in favour of fraudulent companies? I think that the Eskom example that I laid the complaint with you is probably the tip of the iceberg. And I think that there needs to be a hard, laser-like understanding of what is going on in our SOEs. And then finally, on the financing of BEE transactions, I mean, we know that there are many ways to do so, whether it's through vendor finance, through commercial finance. But I've come across a new way of financing, and it is by companies mostly located in Johannesburg that are identifying BEE transactions that are taking place, going to those that are benefiting from the transaction, and then advancing the value of the transaction up front, but for a discounted percentage, say 60% or 70% of the value, taking a bet that in 5 years' time, after the deal has matured, that it will be worth more than the discounts, on the provision that they cede those shares to the financiers after 5 years' time, which takes that business right back to square one again, where they have no BEE value. What is the BEE Commission doing to stamp out those types of immoral financing, which is in fact actually hijacking of companies through the back door using BEE as a front to do so? And what consequences then do we apportion to those candidates who have received those transactions, which bans them from doing them ever again? So we must punish the financiers, but we must also punish those people that are accepting those sorts of deals. Thank you.
While you're on the floor, I think to myself, hey, maybe I should give time when you present the question. But thanks very much, Ms. Feast. And can we take three?
Thank you, Chair. Mine will not be as long as Honourable McPherson's, but I want to start with the issue of what I a little bit controversially so, Chair, is the issue of hypocrisy. I've sat on a number of committees and interviewed over the last few months many, many different committees that come before us. And this particular committee and other committees that I sit on are extremely vocal, and justfully so, when it comes to gender disparity. If a committee comes in here and they are 100% males, those males go out with a whipping. And they are told in no uncertain terms, this is absolutely unacceptable. Rightfully so. But what I'm sometimes seeing, Chair, is an applauding. And applauding when the opposite takes place. When we have committees or when we have departments that are coming where there's 100% female representation, there's an applauding. Now, either we talk about gender equality or we don't. And we apply it equally. I have no problem. And I know that there are some very strong females who do well, and some of them would be even better suited to run the country. I have no problem with that. My problem is with the kind of hypocrisy that I see. And it's not just here. I've seen it in other committees. So I said I'm starting on a fairly controversial note, and so there it is. My next two questions, a comment and maybe a question. I was approached by a gentleman, a father, who was really concerned. He looked like me, like you, but he had the wrong surname. And his son was wanting to advance in life. But because he had the wrong surname, he kept on being kicked out. The father went to the point of wanting to change his son's surname to be an appropriate surname for his son to be able to advance economically. And he came to me and he said to me, this is the problem that we are having. And so you spoke about, Commissioner, the fact that BBBEE is about incorporating those who have been alienated. And here's one who has been alienated under apartheid for years. And there are many others such like him who feel alienated because the policies do not speak to him. So I think that's the first concern that I want to raise. I think the second one is maybe then just a question. Have you considered measuring the success of BBBEE interventions against, for example, growth in GDP, growth in employment, growth in improvement in, you know, poverty alleviation? And if so, has there been that kind of measurement that has been done? And if so, what are those kind of statistics? Thank you, Jay.
Thank you, Jim. thank you, Jim. Now, my colleagues, the members left to me, asked very important questions. Very, very, very important, valid questions. I just want to state the first that I am pro-black economic empowerment and the empowerment of women. But I've got a serious problem with the way that it has been rolled out in practice. Time will tell, and I'm sure that time will learn us expensive lessons of how sustainable it is and the way that it is rolling out. It's a very emotional question. You know, Member Thringia on my left mentioned a person who was excluded. Now, I want to tell you today that my son was excluded. And because of that, he has to work in Rwanda today. He was headhunted by another company in Africa. And he's working in Rwanda. There's lots of stories like that. I want him to be back here one day. So hopefully we'll get to a stage where BBBEE is not necessary anymore, but only BBBEE. Enough of the emotional stuff. What I want to... Sorry? Enough of the emotional stuff. Getting to common sense, Brandon said, business-wise. Taking the MTN Zakile Futhi case as an example, I'm concerned that when Triple B is being rolled out in this way, where a company has to finance a deal itself, that it will impact negatively on the current shareholders. Something of another finance model needs to be considered, as Member McPherson mentioned as well. Because this is not sustainable, can't be sustainable, and it's also in contradiction with company law. And then a second question that I want to ask is, on slide 27, it's mentioned in the second last bullet that state-owned entities and departments not implementing BE. Now, a question I want to ask is, where a department or a state-owned entity needs to appoint someone in a position, whether it be a key or position or any position, and there's not a person available with the necessary qualifications or skills, what would they do then? Would they then appoint someone from the undesignated group to fill that position? Because to my experience, that is not the case. I've seen engineers from Cuba being imported to South Africa, for instance, and doctors. And then people from the undesignated group needs to go overseas if they want to fill positions. I've also got family, four of them, engineers, who were forced to leave the country and to seek employment elsewhere. So I need to know that. And then just a last thing on the report. On page 26, the chairperson actually mentioned it, but I want to ask if it's not possible to give a more comprehensive feedback on the challenges, because we need to know the workload per person, transaction 68 to 1, is that ideal? What should it be? It's the same with advisory services, complaints, reports, etc. This doesn't look good. And I think for us to make a decision or to get a report on this information, we need more in-depth information. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd like to thank the report. I think it was very candid. And I really appreciate your honesty, Commissioner, and your team. I do want to speak on the part of representation. I think it would be amiss of me not to say anything. I think representation matters. I think it matters that there's 100% women that are sitting here, for me, specifically as a black woman. As women, I'm going to say it in Xhosa, singaphansi. We are marginalized and we are not given spaces. So when we see women who own the spaces and 100% black women, it's very good for us as black women to see that for the long haul. My questions are, or my comments, on the part of I get a sense from your presentation that you have concerns in terms of how far your mandate goes as the commission. And it worries me because it seems that you speak about the decline from 32% to 25.2% in black ownership. What do you plan on being aggressive when it comes to increasing that amount in terms of the companies? In terms of what can we do as a committee to amend the act that's going to give you powers to execute and to make companies comply. And it's said that you have to make companies comply at this point in the democracy, when we do have actually people that have the skills that can do the work but don't given a chance. I've seen it myself working in the private sector where you are able to do the job 100%, but you're not given a chance based on your skin because basically you're a BEE so-called token. So we don't want to have children in the next generation who sit as tokens of BEE, but we want them to be assimilated with the right skills so that they can do the work. So I think maybe amending the Act in a way that enforces the Commission to do the work to completion would go a long way. Another point I'd like to ask is that how do we enforce CETAs, you know, the companies that that accept graduates or potential CETA people that are deployed by the CETAs, because you find that sometimes they spend 2 years with the companies, but then they're not assimilated into the system, which means then they become cheap labor. So that for the 2 years, the company is using those same people as cheap labor and then doesn't assimilate. Is there a way of making sure there's a percentage of those that are sent through CETAs that gets absorbed by the companies? Lastly, I have a concern because I feel like you are sort of, you're holding a mountain on your shoulders and you're expected to do this much work, but yet the amount of tools that you have are very limited. I'm worried about the fact that you have staff shortages. I'm worried about the fact that you have you don't have space with which to operate on, and the fact that you don't have mandate to fully apply your power as a commission. Also, I'm worried about the fact that you don't have a succession plan in terms of who will then take over from you. You're not going to be commissioner forever. So what is your succession plan in making sure that you assimilate young women, young black people who are going to come and take over at this point, knowing what the work of the commission truly is? Thank you.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Let me first welcome the presentation. It's very much informative in terms of how processes are unfolding outside here. But one, I just need clarity, Chair, as to how are they doing, how are they trying to deal with this ease of doing business? For instance, if you register a company, CIPC register a company in 1 day, and in 1 day you have to get this, in 5 days you have to get the BE certificate in terms of turnaround. So I'm not so sure how are they aligned to the CIPC in terms of ease of doing business. Because I just see 5 days turnaround here in terms of registration, BE certificate. The other one is, do you have any plan in dealing with the non-compliance? One, we start with government entities, SOEs, and private sector. Because seemingly most of them, they're not complying in the BE, triple BE space, and the Act of Government. Also, in terms of the education and awareness program, I don't think the entity is doing enough. Yeah, what? It's still urbanized, as I spoke earlier on, to say we must at least decentralize this thing. Because if you can check 54 programs vis-a-vis a program, one program in each province, it's a challenge. Is skewed, you know? And if we are talking inclusive economic growth, we must also impart the skills and the understanding and the knowledge of those ruralitarians there. Yeah. Also, the program of curbing the fronting tendencies. I don't know whether we're still in intact. Because the matter of you not being autonomous still reliant on DTI and offices and space. How are you going to execute your task? And how far are you in terms of the listing processes? So that as, as a committee, what assistance you require from us so that you are able to deal with those issues? Last but not least, I'm not so sure in terms of the funding model. You spoke of funders or funding agencies, and we do have in this department like NEF, IDC, DTI, CIFA. Are they not part of assisting the process now? One of the funders. And because my understanding is that before they fund, somehow they have to consult you in the process in terms of compliance, whether this program is compliant so that they are able to find. Because at some stage you can't have two BE certificates. I really don't understand why one entity can have two BE certificates. You see, maybe last, but the last one is the 51 black shareholdings. If you have information, you can clarify for me. Because really, people are using black people to say they are just front desk there, but on their company, you find they registered the black name there. But it's just a front desk, an operator, or a telephone or receptionist, but on a company, it's registered as a shareholder and 51 black shareholding. But in terms of dividends and shareholding, it's not part. So how are you going to deal with such element of funding? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Maybe I should actually come back to the commission and the team. Commissioner and the team, so actually just respond, or maybe to comments and questions raised by members. Okay, floor is yours.
Chair, thank you very much. Chair, let me just quickly, in summary, speak to the slides around our challenges, because some of the issues that have come through relate to those challenges. Chair, when we started the commission, firstly, is an unfunded mandate. So when we started, Treasury stated clearly that there wouldn't be funds that are allocated from the fiscus, but that the DTI should look for a budget for the commission within itself. And after that, then Treasury will be able to list the entity so that it can operate, but with the budget that has been allocated from the programs of the DTI through a reprioritization process. And as we've indicated, if you look at our financial plan on that slide, slide 24, when we conservatively looked at our plan in terms of what our needs are, and you'll see that the majority of our budget is really compensation of employees. So we basically just want the human beings to be able to come in to carry out the mandate. So we started with the budget that is reflected in there. And the DTI, even through reprioritization, could not identify an amount that even equals what we're looking for, conservatively assessed. And they were able to identify 59 million for the year that we are reporting on right now. However, this 59 million sits under a transfer line because the commission was supposed to be listed. So it sits under a transfer line. The commission is unable to access it. So it's money that is supposedly the commission's money, but the commission cannot access it because it's not listed. So that is the challenge. So for that year, you will see that we would not have used the money because it's money that we should be using to employ people, but we've got no access to it. And so that is the challenge around the listing. And I think that is where we request that this committee assist in facilitating that the listing happens. Let me indicate again why the listing should not be questionable. If you look at the legislation, this committee expected the BBB Commission to to be a regulator that is an entity that is going to act independently, objectively, impartially, without fear, favor, or prejudice. So it also states very clearly in terms of how it should be funded. It indicates that its funding should be appropriated through a parliamentary process here, as any entity that should be operating. Also, the finances of the commission should be independently audited by the Auditor General. This is very clear in the legislation. We are unable to get audited by the Auditor General because we are not an entity. Therefore, we get audited as part of the overall DTI audit. So we are not able to even comply with the provisions of the BBB legislation because of the fact that we are not listed. So it is important that we get that right, and that the listing then can also give us the ability to independently look for operational space to operate, the office space to operate. So when we started, because we had no funding, we then requested one of the entities of the DTI, which at the time had some space, some additional space, which is the National Gambling Board. And Honorable McPherson is fortunate because has been to our offices. The boardroom that you saw, Honorable McPherson, that we met with you in, that's the only boardroom where all of our meetings are taking place. We've got to structure our meetings in such a way that we are able to meet all of our stakeholders. We even have meetings outside working hours to accommodate all of the stakeholders because people need assistance and the commission doesn't have the infrastructure to give that. So we are continuously squatting because we don't have enough office space. In fact, at the moment, even if we were to employ one additional person, there is no space for them to sit anywhere. So you should, in fact, physically, if you come to our offices, you'll see we're even fighting for breathing space with the boxes, our educational material and all of that, because we are literally squatting. And then in terms of the human resources that we require, you'll see that in terms of our plan, based on our strategy that was approved, we are looking for 123 people to do our work effectively. We think that if we have that, we will be able to do a lot. Yes, we'll use other means to reach more and more areas. Yes, we understand that 123 people will not, but if we've got 123 professional people that are in the organization, we should be able to do that. The one thing that we do not want, Chair, is a situation where we've got to outsource our investigations. Investigations are very sensitive. We don't want service providers to do sensitive work of the commission. We would like our own staff members to be the ones that are doing the work of the commission. So without the resources, in some instances, we might be compelled to use a service provider to do a particular investigation. That, in a way, yes, we can control issues around confidentiality and all of that, but it's not an ideal situation. So we'd like to get that. And at the moment, as we've indicated there in slide 25, you'll see that our needs is 123 people, but what we have now is only 39 people. And I just want to indicate that, in fact, sometimes there's a positive that comes out of something that is so bad. Because we didn't have any funding, we didn't have any money, we managed to recruit new trainees, which were graduates, that were unemployed. And so this staff that you're seeing there, the 39 people, the majority of it is graduates, black graduates that had no job, that had their first job at the commission. We've trained them. We've now absorbed them into the structure. So that gave us an opportunity, in fact, to create our own pool, to create our own succession plan. So the team that you see here as well, in terms of the executives that are in the commission, we took these people also from within the department itself, looking at the skills that the commission requires to start building the organization. So, and our succession plan is very, very clear, but I must indicate that we actually even advertised for a deputy commissioner, because it is important that we have a deputy commissioner so that we can also have proper succession. But I am confident that the people that are sitting here, Chair, with me at any time, if I'm not there, they'll be able to take over. That is the other thing that you should also be comforted with, because they know the work of the commission all round. It's not even only their area. So everybody's doing everything in the commission. I even personally have investigations that are allocated to me because we don't have enough resources. So there are some, this technical work that I also do. And everybody does both technical and high-level work. So everyone is involved, and that helps to build the capacity that the commission will need in the future. And whoever is going to join the commission can actually find that kind of operational environment that does not limit somebody to their job description, that everybody does what the commission requires. And just to also indicate, Honourable Member, I must apologize, Chair, that because it's my first time in this committee, in the next session, I'm sure that I will know all of the members' names properly so that I can address them appropriately, so we can apologize for that. But I just want to indicate that we've got also an equity plan, employment equity plan. So as I indicated, as much as you see 100% women here in the executive, that's not the totality of our structure. But also because there are executive positions, about four, that will be available, those will be filled in accordance with our employment equity plan requirement that will then achieve the necessary diversity. So we're not ignorant to what the requirements of this country are. We need to ensure that the entity is as diverse as possible, and we will be doing that. And our plan is available for inspection. In fact, at some point, an organization came and asked the commission for its employment equity plan, and we sat down with them, we opened it, and they were happy with it because they were afraid that perhaps there may be some exclusion and so forth. So we are committed to the employment equity legislation. Chair, I've indicated that those are our challenges at an operational level, that we wish we have enough resources to do the work. Yes, there is always, when people speak about triple BEE, they will then try to relate it to corruption as if triple BEE is equivalent of corruption. And we want to dispel that. In fact, corruption happens in many spaces at all levels, and it should be dealt with, you know, unapologetically. It must not be linked to say, oh, it's because of BEE that there's corruption. No, no, no. People that are corrupt get to be corrupt because they're corrupt. It's got nothing to do with BEE. However, what we have found is that people have used the opportunities around triple BEE to pursue their corrupt intents. Yes, rent seeking, where you find people basically just being an intermediary for a company to benefit points, when a person just gets just a financial benefit, there's no ownership, there's no real decision making. We find those rent seeking type arrangements, which should not be happening. And so I always say, in fact, when we make some of the decisions, like Honorable McPherson indicated, when we make some of the decisions, I always say this committee must look back and say, that's the reason why we needed this regulator. That's the reason why, because it wasn't there, we were not able to see these things. We're not able to deal with them. We're not able to address them. So the reason for all of those rent-seeking arrangements, the fronting schemes that were going unabated, like unapologetically, people used to structure these schemes in a way that only certain people who should not be benefiting from these schemes are the beneficiaries in the name of empowerment. And that has been happening because there was no regulator. That is the reason why the commission is there, Chair. So we accept that there are tendencies that were happening, but we are beginning to see a change of behavior, particularly if you look at the presentation that Busi shared with us. You'll see that the request for guidance from the private sector, from the public sector, is actually increasing, meaning that a lot of companies now are willing now to do the right thing, and we should take advantage of that to assist them. So if we have got enough resources to be able to guide proper implementation, we're going to avoid then instances of fronting that are taking place. There's one case that we were dealing with where, for instance, like these funding arrangements that we're talking about, where an entity just got into a deal and was given finance by the funders of about, let me say, 10 million. And the entity has to date paid over 200 million back to the funders. And that entity, which is supposedly the shareholder, the black shareholder, to date has no cent benefit to itself, because the arrangement was structured that when the dividends get to be paid into this company, on the very same day, they move out to the funder. So if you had that kind of, and these kinds of arrangements were very prevalent in our market, in our economy. So now the advantage about the BBB legislation right now is that the major B transactions now are reported to us. We are able to pick up those things as, because in terms of the requirement, when a deal is concluded today, within 15 days, you're supposed to file it with the commission. So we're able to pick up those funding conditions that are undermining transformation, and we are able to give the companies feedback and say, this and this should not be there. Please remove them, revise your agreement this way, and revise. And I'll tell you that there are a few that were very, very stubborn, not wanting to change and saying, no, the commission has got no mandate to make us undo these transactions. If you don't undo it, then Busi's section will refer it for investigation, because that what it means is that you are fronting. There is absolutely no way that you can call it a BEE ownership deal, but the only person that is benefiting out of it is the funder. And often the funder is not a black person. That is defined in terms of this act. And I want to also go back to say that in terms of the people that feel excluded, there are also other things that the definition of black people in the act had to be very clear and clarified for everyone to understand. When we say black people, it means Indians, Africans, it means colors. So it's based on those classifications that were there, those people that were previously excluded because of that classification. So when we say black, there is absolutely no reason for a person that was classified as colored not to be able to get a benefit from the legislation, as well as a person that was classified as Indian before not to get a benefit. And then there's this part about the Chinese. This sometimes is is confused. There's a case that we dealt with where we made findings, where a company claimed to be 50% black, and the information that they relied on was the two Chinese shareholders, and they regarded those as black. But when you look at them, they do not qualify because they were not in South Africa at the time. They were not excluded. They do not qualify in terms of the population register of those Chinese people that, in terms of the constitutional court judgment, are entitled to benefit under BEE. So that company has agreed to implement the remedials that the commission has put on that particular matter. So, Chair, there's a whole lot of issues that have been raised, but I'm going to allow just quickly my colleagues to respond to some of the questions, and then if there's anything that I still need to clarify, then I will clarify. But I think it is important that we understand that. And when I said earlier, Chair, that the BBB legislation provides an opportunity for real partnership between black and white businesses, there is absolutely no need for a company that is operating in this country to even go and operate in Australia and so forth, because it's completely excluded. There are joint venture arrangements that, if they are structured properly with the assistance of the commission guiding them, then they can actually do business, continue to do business in this country. So I think there's a way that BBB presents in terms of opportunities to do business for all of the people, because what we are seeking is an inclusive economy. It's not an economy that continues to exclude somebody else because others were previously excluded. So there are a number of opportunities, but the commission is there to assist and guide. Sister P, maybe let me hand over to you to address some of the questions that have come up, and then so that we can see how far we can go. Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner. I won't take them. I will just take them randomly. The one of ease of doing business, we must mention, in fact, yesterday the CIPC launched another portal What they are doing now is that they also issue BBB certificates. So when you register your company, you can actually, if you are what you call a micro enterprise or a black-owned QSE, you can actually, no, currently it's AME, you can actually apply for your, register your company and immediately apply for a CIP, they call it a CIPC BBB certificate. And also if you qualify for a SONA affidavit, that form you can complete it immediately because it's downloadable from our website and also from the DTI's website. So there's no five day waiting period. And also when you're renewing, you know, you're doing your annual return with CIPC, you can also do your BBB certificate. It's part and parcel of that. And as you mentioned that you're also now linking with CSD, CIPC is also linked with SARS. And yesterday they were also linking now to UIF and the compensation fund. So as you can see, it's becoming quite a bouquet of way when doing business with CIPC, you can actually link to these other entities. So I think we are slowly getting there. And then I think there was an issue of compliance reporting that came out. So I'll respond to all those questions with one or two responses. Early this year, we had an engagement with the GSE, and they have made compliance reporting as part of compulsory reporting for all GST listed companies. And they actually, what they required us to do this year was to also send them a list of companies that are not reporting. So they wrote to them, and we've seen a spike in reports coming through. So we think that it's going to be okay. And then as far as government is concerned, last year we had an engagement with Auditor General. We raised the issue that government is really not doing verification or is not compliant. So what they've done now, they've made part of their auditing process, they also now look at whether government is implementing BBBE and whether they've submitted their compliance report. So we have seen quite a number now of requests for training on BBBE, and most government entities are actually going for their verification. So I think next time we come here, Chair, there should be the number that you're seeing now, there should be an increase based on the engagement that we had with the Auditor General. And what they also promised us that currently they're just looking at whether government entities are reporting, but they'll also now go into the nitty-gritty to say what are they reporting in terms of those elements. Decentralization of education, if you look at the spread, I can't remember what slide it was, I just want to go to it. So what you mentioned here was the provincial conferences, but if you look at the total number of workshops or information sessions that we have conducted, between last year and this year, and quarter two this year, we've already done 119. Now, most of these are not in Gauteng. You can see there's a spread. Gauteng, yes, is still high, but because it's also government entities that we're asking for education. But we get invited, especially Eastern Cape Free State and KwaZulu-Natal. We've been to KwaMhlabuyalanga, KwaDukuza, you know, on the outskirts. So whenever we get invited, it doesn't matter where we avail ourselves. Because as we mentioned, we don't have resources. So we're not going to go to each and every town. But whenever I get an invite, we use that as an opportunity to go and teach. But with these provincial conferences, what I was highlighting is that we then pick up people from our outlying areas and bring them to the conference. So even though the conference could have been in East London, but the people that came to that conference were from outside in rural and semi-urban areas. So we do try and do that. I'll tackle this one a little bit, but I think the commissioner will add on it. Honorable McPherson, the once empowered and always empowered issue. There are two issues here. What you're looking at when you're assessing, we have seen that actually over 90% of the transactions that have been lodged, there's no transformation at all. So on paper, they look good. But what we're finding is that there's no value add to black people. Most of them, even when they leave with nothing. We were in a meeting with the commissioners last year where black people started with a loan of 900 million. When we met with the company, the loan was standing at 2.5 billion. It shows that it was not being serviced. And this is not an isolated incident. We have a lot of these cases. So most of the black people, when they exit with nothing. Instead, most of them live with a debt. So it's a nice principle. If BBB was being implemented correctly, then we'll talk about all these empowered ones empowered. But when we have not even seen the benefits flowing to black people, I don't think you'll be there yet. But there's a second element, what you call a continued consequence. What it says is that if there were black people in your entity, for 3 years after the exit, you can still claim blackness, because it realizes that there's no way you could just find a ready-made black person to get into a scheme with you. So, but even then, we have to assess to say when the black people exited within the scheme, was the scheme aligned? Did it not contravene? Was it not a funding scheme? If it was not a funding scheme, it was properly put into place. For three years after they leave, you can still recognize that black ownership. So that's what the legislation has done. Unfortunately, what we're seeing currently is really not pleasing. I think some of the questions will be answered by my investigation colleague whilst I try and find a way.
Thank you very much, Bill. Mine is on the investigation side. Where is there any political interference with the cases that we have received? For now, we have not received any political interference with the cases that we are complaining. In fact, we are getting support to do our work properly. And also, we have not received any complaint involving a politician. And I would like to thank Mr. McPherson for opening the case on our behalf, because for now, I can safely say that it's a nightmare for us to go and open a case at a police station, because of not all the members from SAPS are conversant with the issue of funding. So it's a sort of a nightmare when you have to go and open a case. I remember we went to Rustenburg. We came back without opening a case because there was none of the police that understood what fronting is. We were just given a phone number to say, please contact this investigator. He might assist you. So not all the police station do have people that are conversant with the term fronting. So we are in a process of trying to have a meeting so as we can maybe have a committee that we can they do a training on fronting and BEE Act to say what is it that we need from our police officers in our police station. And also, as Mr. McPherson indicated that he wants also us to make a follow-up on the case that we have opened, I will also come to you and request the case number so as we can be able to see how far is our police in investigating the matter. And that's all from the side of the investigation.
Okay, I've just picked up others. The issue where we asked whether we've got powers to enforce companies to absorb, unfortunately we don't have those powers. But what the legislation says or does, it says that even if you have taken people on apprenticeship or internship, if we cannot absorb them and another entity absorbs them, we can still claim points for that. So which talks to tracking to say you should track who was in your system and then who exited and where they are, because you still get recognized for having had them within your system. We have not done research yet to compare issues of poverty alleviation, because the emphasis so far has been on the five elements of the BBB Act, but it's something that maybe moving forward we can look at. But for now, we just focus on the codes themselves. So maybe it's something to consider. Thank you for that.
Chair, just in conclusion, just wrapping up some of the issues. Quickly, just in terms of the approach of the Commission, we've got both the compliance strategy as well as the corrective enforcement strategy. So in everything that we do, we look at the merit of the matter and decide what intervention is more appropriate to achieve the act. So we're not barking trigger happy. You know, like it's not like we're there, and also we're not sitting waiting for entities to make a mistake so that we can pounce. We believe that achieving the objectives of the Act is going to be done properly if everybody is doing the right thing and the majority of the people are doing the right thing, so that our resources for enforcement and taking criminal steps and all of those should be left for those that blatantly disregard the legislation. But we have balanced our strategy so that we can assist companies, and those that are willingly, you know, ready to be assisted, we can see them. They are taking up the assistance. Chair, I just want to say that in terms of the ease of doing business again, I just want to say that sometimes the things that are introduced in the codes, in the legislation, are undermined in practice. For instance, in terms of just the ease of doing business, the codes are very clear that if you are an exempted micro enterprise, you are an enterprise that has got a revenue of less than 10 million. You don't have to pay a cost to be verified. You qualify for an automatic level. An automatic level that you can then, through an affidavit, confirm that I am a white-owned entity that has got a turnover of less than 10 million, and you will qualify for an automatic level 4. All right. If you are a black-owned entity, like 51% black-owned, you will then qualify for a level 2 automatically. So you don't need anybody to verify you and you paying for a certificate. However, the reason why I say that on implementation, we found that there are certain private sector entities that will reject an affidavit that a small entity submits to them. Same with government entities. When an entity submits a sworn affidavit, they reject it and they say, no, we want the certificate. You cannot do that. So we have then said to the entities, report to the commission. So we've seen actually a change. Most of the entities that were requiring and rejecting these sworn affidavits are now accepting them. That is a huge intervention that government did to say that we should not place unnecessary burden, compliance burden on smaller enterprises. And that is something that we must accept and appreciate. But also, in terms of the flexibility in the legislation, other people have always said, without necessarily going to the legislation, to say the legislation is anti-investment. However, if you look at the BBBE framework, you will see that within that framework, for instance, Section 10 of the legislation gives the SOEs an opportunity to get a deviation from the minimum set generic codes, and also an exemption upon motivation. So they can motivate, so they can deviate either higher, or they can go down, or they can be exempted for a particular period. They must just apply to the Minister of Trade and Industry to do that. That is embedded in the legislation to provide the flexibility where the market conditions or circumstances are demanding of that. So that is basically something that is important for both our local players as well as international players, because it gives the flexibility. The problem is when that gets to be abused. But at the moment, I think we cannot say anything about that being abused, because in fact, those exemption applications, we have not seen the Minister of Trade and Industry gazetting even a single approval, meaning that they are not coming through, all right? Meaning that people are okay, but the flexibility is there. Then the second flexibility that is there is that if you're a multinational and your policy does not allow you to dispose of equity outside your own jurisdiction, you are allowed to do what is called equity equivalent. So in terms of that program, it's in the codes. The multinational that is not able to comply with the ownership element by giving equity is allowed to contribute towards something else in lieu of ownership. All right. So that is there. It's a flexibility that is embedded. There are a number of entities that have taken advantage of that. We know that, I think, Caterpillar is part of that, Samsung. And so they are allowed, they are able to get an appropriate level without necessarily doing an ownership deal, because there's the equity equivalent. So the ease of doing business, we measure it on our side from, is this policy a hindrance to doing business? Are there flexibilities that are embedded? And I think our also relationship with SARS, that's why our MOUs,
were very strategic because the partners we chose are the partners that are adding value to the system as opposed to just partnerships for the sake of it. So we've got an MOU with CIPC, we've got access to their system, real-time access to information, and so forth and so forth. And also we're seeing that the certificates that they're issuing also to exempted micro enterprises are even helping now, because people also feel that if it's just an affidavit, it doesn't look strong enough to be presented. So the CIPC certificates are also assisting them. So in terms of the publications of the Commission's finding, and I think this is the one area that we request this committee to look very closely into it. In terms of Section 13J7A of the Act, it says that the Commission may publish any of its findings or recommendations in a manner that it deems fit. However, Section 13J7B of that then puts limitations on that ability to publish our findings. It says to us, if the matter has been referred, for instance, for a criminal process, we cannot publish. So if we make a recommendation that a particular entity, based on our findings, must be referred for a criminal process, we cannot publish that up until that criminal process is finalized. All right? That is the limitation that is there on the Commission. And also another unfair limitations, which you cannot find in any other pieces of legislation that are progressive, is that we are not able to publish if somebody says to us, no, I intend to review your decision. So for that part, for that time, we are not able to publish what we have found as the Commission. It says we may not publish up until that judicial review process is complete or the time that is allowed for a person to institute that has been completed. So that time in terms of PAJA is 180 days. So once we've made our findings and a person says, I intend reviewing you, we cannot do anything in terms of publication for that 180 days. And in fact, in the four judicial reviews that we have, the companies filed their review papers on the last day of the 180 days. To see that, you know, sometimes it also presents opportunity for the Commission's work to be frustrated unnecessarily. But we do not understand why the limitation on publication of the work that we've done. We've investigated, we've made findings. Why can't we publish the work that we've done? So that is one area that in the previous committee, in the previous administration chair, that's one of the factors that we've listed to say this is an unnecessary limitation that you will not find it anywhere. Yes, you can review the Commission, but there's absolutely no reason for that limitation to be there. And I understand Honourable McPherson is saying that he got a legal opinion on that. We have two legal opinions, Honourable McPherson, and they do tell us that we actually could publish. All right. So you'll see that some of the matters we publish. But we act with caution because we are a regulator. Where there's a potential for prejudice, we choose to act more in the interest of preventing prejudice as opposed to just saying we think we are right, we'll do it. So I think it is important for us to understand that. So we've got the legal opinions, but there are certain steps that we take towards publication. And where we have published, you will see that we've published and we've done so, and unapologetically so. Chair, in conclusion, I just want to say that also in terms of the issue, why a company would operate with 2B certificates? You'll be shocked how many companies are operating with 2B certificates. When you look at the other certificates, the other one will tell you it's 51% black owned. Then the other certificate will tell you it's not. Because they've got two certificates depending on who they need to be submitting to. So it is important, but that kind of conduct we're beginning to root it out, because these B certificates are sent to the Commission. Companies are now, when they receive the certificate, before they actually just sign with the entities, they call the Commission and ask us to verify if the certificate is valid or not. So we're able to do our own initial work and then tell them that, no, you can proceed or not proceed. So it is important that we understand that. But, Chair, the level of compliance, both from the private sector and the public sector, I think it's the same. There was a tick box approach to BEE. In the private sector, there was clearing circumvention where people just wanted to get the points so that they are achieving a level that is required for a big concession wherever, and we've seen that. So in pursuit of that, the private sector has done things that are gross. There's an 80-year-old man who sits somewhere in, what is that place, Busin Bumaranga? Where you went? In Mbombela, around there. An 80-year-old man who's a 51% shareholder of a company that's got a huge corridor, the Maputo Corridor contract. That man is sitting there, is not participating in anything, he's not getting any dividends. The company is operating with his black ownership, and he knows nothing about it. It continues to happen now, today. When they present their certificate, it will say 51% black owned. When you're asking for the ID copy of Mr. So-and-so, they will give it to you to confirm it. But they have that ID copy because every year they go to him and get him to sign the documents that they need to operate for each year. And then when they go there, they give him a few thousand rents for family to survive, and he has no clue what they are using that for. We had another case where an ex-member of parliament, if he is not necessarily a member of parliament, sorry, just in conclusion, there was that member of parliament who lodged a complaint with the commission where he was made a BE partner, and through this black ownership of his, the company applied for a lease at DPW here in the Cape Town for a renewable energy project. And that lease was given. And after they got the lease, she was kicked out of the company. And you can understand that companies will go to an extent of getting black ownership to get something. Once that lease is given, because it's renewable, it's a 30-year lease, renewable, so it basically is perpetual. But you, as the black person that was used, you have been now left in the lurch. Then they know that you don't have the muscle to fight it. You won't have money to fight it. They just continue. You'll fight and fight. So the commission has presented a voice check, not only to black people that have been fronted knowingly. There are a number of black people that only discover as we go to the provinces with these sessions that they're actually in a deal that they didn't realize it was fronting. And they're bringing those things to us, and we are trying to resolve them as much as we can. But the resources are a challenge.
I could see that there were hands coming up. I've got a few minutes to 12. Can I actually ask that at 12 we reconvene? And I think what will be quite important, because in terms of legislation we have before us, there is actually an important clause on 13B1, that the Broad-Based Black Economic Empowerment Commission is hereby established as an entity within the administration of the department. Because of that, I think what will be very important for us to actually look at, on slide 27, I think what brings us together, I think with the committee members' involvement to some extent, because I think that's what actually got scourge of the fronting. Can we say this is the main and most important issue that we may have to spend a bit of time, follow through, and I think we should actually acknowledge positively as well the contribution of members of this committee towards that same issue, and I think we should actually then encourage all members. It can be political or not, it doesn't matter, fraud, corruption is corruption, and we should actually proceed in that way, in a way of actually picking up on that issue. So I wanted just to maybe conclude, and my apology for members that we can't actually take a further discussion. So you just had too much passion. I couldn't actually say you must stop now. And I thought, no, let me just allow it to go through. So can we say on the basis of what I've actually read that 24, slide number 24 on finance, that footnote point, we should actually ask the departments and follow through on that point. Same as the human resource one on page 25, follow through on those issues. And obviously on slide 26, there is actually issues of operations. And the final one is actually just the highlight of the slide 27, which is fronting, which I think is actually much more broader, and we may actually have to have more interaction. We really appreciate that we could have an opportunity, because we report to the department quarterly, and on our part in terms of engagement, it's an opportunity for us to be able to get the commission to come before us, and in terms of our discussion, it's not something we will actually have privilege to engage regularly. But I think at this stage, it will be important that we also ask the department to help us pick up on the issue and follow through. So I think we may want to actually conclude and reconvene at, what time is it now? Because we have another, we've got 7 minutes. We actually have to reconvene and actually proceed with the next presentation. Maxim, can I actually ignore you and ask that we actually
can we reconvene?
All the questions
now,
that we asked.
This is now the second time you are doing this.
Look, let me just do this. No one has been given a follow-up opportunity.
Yes, but when my question has not been given,
I must be able
to express that.
Can I just say, if everyone has that opportunity, we won't have enough time.
So it's okay.
And I've deliberately just
said
that.
It's okay to ignore questions.
No, it's not ignoring of question. Can I just say, no one has made a follow-up question. I am concluding.
It's not a follow-up question. It's to ask why my question hasn't been answered.
Can I actually just ask that follow-up question we are not going to take? I am actually rounding up and concluding the issue.
I'm trying to understand why my question wasn't answered in the first place.
Well, can I just say all questions that were asked will be submitted in writing.
What was the question I asked that hasn't been answered?
All questions that the secretariat are recording that. That question, when it goes out, you think it was not done properly? Yes, it's going to be done like that. So all questions that were asked will be submitted in writing. We will actually get those responses. Can I just say that's how we're going to conclude? Can we reconvene at 12? Because we need to take the next presentation. Thank you very much.